R.I.P. George Michael, for the phenomenally gifted yet utterly tormented artist. Many will ask, was he the victim of fame, hedonism, maybe even HIV and AIDS, or all of the above? Well, we now know the singer was nursing a secret heroin habit to go along with his all-night partying and recent ponderous weight gain. Elvis with a heroin habit. Certainly, after all his brushes with death, this appears a slow suicide. For example, George Michael told one interviewer a few years back that his daily routine involved getting up, smoking a joint of marijuana, and going onto the Hampstead Heath, a notorious area in London, to pick up a partner for casual sex. Further, he stated he once had the habit of absorbing 25 joints a day, which kept him sane and healthy. So is there a lesson for the rest of us in this fame-soaked, amoral culture in which we are marinated daily, in a culture that positively worships fetishes, anything goes, and letting it all hang out? Could the lesson be here that such things don't bring happiness, health, or peace of mind? And what is the point of becoming an entertainer, a successful singer, a superstar, if this is what it leads to? Political correctness has effectively separated moral acts from their inevitable outcome. In this sense, the PC movement has caused great blindness to fall across our once mighty land. In fact, in every attempt we have to make sense of our world by common sense and traditional analysis, we are blocked from doing any deep theorizing. In other words, according to the liberal view of life, no deed which has been condemned in the past as immoral is allowed to cause a negative effect. Unfortunately, well, it's too late to save George Michael. Perhaps this can be another valuable lesson for us not to take at face value the supposed joys of celebrity and pop culture superstardom. Certainly, if George's life now appears wasted, can we not agree that there must be a better way? Isn't there more to life? Good morning. Hope you had a great Christmas. It was really, I guess, shocked but not surprised when I saw that George Michael had died. So, was I a huge fan of his? No, not really. But I have actually, I think I bought one album of his and listened to it for a couple of months. And very talented songwriter. Very, very talented guy, but a very tormented person. And he seemed to really cultivate, obviously he wanted to be a superstar. And yet when he was overwhelmed by it, then he complained about it. But, I mean, you know, that's the whole thing that he was aiming for, was to become a star, a big star, famous, wealthy, and everything. But it seems like, I mean, obviously somewhere the guy's life took a wrong turn. Seemed like a nice, you know, a fairly nice person. And there's a lot of stories out there of him doing charitable work, doing kind of private charity acts. But he had been, I think, in a downward spiral. I think one of the things that would be worth kind of talking about in his case was, you know, this idea that you go do what you want and it's all going to work out for you, that the left has put out. You know, there was always a counterculture out there. But at one time, the counterculture was outside of the norms. It was outside of not only what was accepted, but was thought to be a good life. And if people went into the counterculture, they joined you can think of a thousand different ways that people kind of stepped off the path. There would be some society cost. You know, people would look down on them. They would talk about them. Somebody had a baby out of wedlock, for example, would cause that person to have a ruined reputation. And so that doesn't happen anymore. And to a large extent, the politically correct movement is responsible for that. But what about all the, for example, what about all the victims? What about all the fatherless kids out there, or the kids that didn't come into a strong family? I mean, you can't have it both ways, you know. So anyway, I mean, it seemed like George Michael was a guy that if you listen to his music, he was just a great songwriter, you know, in terms of melodies. Had a real, I mean, sense of charisma or sense of the moment. But this guy had been abusing drugs for a long, long time. And, you know, it's this kind of this interesting article in this. I got this story from got this great story from a site called Boing Boing. Frank Sinatra to George Michael on coping with fame. Swing, man. So this is published yesterday. Let me just read this to you. From this is something that written September 9th, 1990, or published September 9th, 1990. After he became a global phenomenon, George Michael considered retirement to get away from the demands of fame, telling the LA Times Calendar magazine that he planned to reduce the strain of his celebrity status. Once Frank Sinatra heard about this, he wrote back and encouraged him to continue cultivating his talent. Dear friends, when I saw your calendar cover today about George Michael, the reluctant pop star, my first reaction was he should thank the good Lord every morning when he wakes up to have all that he has. And that'll make two of us thanking God every morning for all that we have. I don't understand a guy who lives in hopes of reducing the strain of his celebrity status. Here's a kid who wanted to be a pop star since he was about 7 years old. That was a quote. And now that he's a smash performer and songwriter at 27, he wants to quit doing what tons of gifted youngsters all over the world would shoot grandma for. Just one crack at what he's complaining about. Come on, George, loosen up. Swing, man. Dust off those gossamer wings and fly yourself to the moon of your choice and be grateful to carry the baggage we've all had to carry since those lean nights of sleeping on buses and helping the drivers unload the instruments. And no more of that talk about, quote, the tragedy of fame. The tragedy of fame is when no one shows up and you're singing to the cleaning lady in some empty joint that hasn't seen a paying customer since St. Swithin's Day. And you're now nowhere near that. You're top dog on the top rung of a tall ladder called stardom, which in Latin means thanks to the fans who were there when it was in the beginning, when it was all very lonely. Talent must not be wasted. Those who have it, and you obviously do, or today's calendar cover article would have been about Rudy Vallee. Those who have talent must hug it, embrace it, nurture it, and share it, lest it be taken away from you as fast as it was loaned to you. Trust me, I've been there. Yours, Frank Sinatra. So it's kind of a good response to this whole thing. I mean, don't you believe 523-1450? Don't you believe that also? I mean, we're different from the days when Frank Sinatra became famous, because there is this weird evolution that has occurred in pop culture in which a person who's a success, an entertainer, morphs into one of the greatest minds in the world. And so this person is then fit not just to sing a song or write a movie script, but they are set up to have the most insightful opinions on any topic. So we almost turn these people into gods, and yet a lot of these people are, you know, coming out of Lost back, you know, lost minds, worlds, worldviews, family histories, lives in which they were unhappy. And so they're going to go to Hollywood or wherever to try to get acceptance on a massive scale. And so George Michael had a very fraught relationship with his father, and his he was a mama's boy. I think he would admit that. Very close to his mother. When his mother died, his life kind of fell apart. But he, you know, was an unhappy person. A lot of people who go to Hollywood have histories where they've been abused or rejected by their family, by, you know, so the fact that we've set these people up for godhood, I think, means that we've taken away that position of leadership from, you know, individuals, the traditional individuals in the society who we would look up to, the ministers and business people and stuff. And now we have the culture that we have, which is a culture where people can do anything that they want. The crazier it is, the more we're supposed to stand up and cheer for them. And we're supposed to be encouraging other people to do anything they want with just a few boundaries. You know, like these people that are transgender. I don't know how many genders they're supposed to be now, but, you know, we don't even pay any attention whether these individuals are happy once they go through these things, once they act on their impulses. There's some outrage right now over the person on the front of National Geographic. I think it's National Geographic, but it is a I'm trying to remember. Let me find this here for you. But it's the, and we do have a phone call, but it's a magazine in which you would never expect something like this on the front. There's a transgendered kid. And if you just hung up on me, call back. I'm sorry, missed your call, but this kid is 7. And so what is really upsetting people about this experience is these parents who I believe claim to be Christians, I have no idea obviously what they really believe, but encourage this kid to do this. We've got a call. Thanks for the call, the Kelly O'Connell Show. Who's this? Turn off your radio. Call in, turn off your radio because it'll echo in the background. The day my 4-year-old son told me he was a girl. So there is some outrage out there that a child as young as 4 years old, an age which obviously a child who's 4 wouldn't know the difference between reality and make believe, comes up to the parents and says, I'm a girl. And maybe because this little boy said this 2 days in a row, the parents said, oh my God, we've got to do something about this. So they started to help the child transition. Now, most people think of parents as people that are guides, they're trainers, they are meant to be, you know, to give the child love and everything. And, you know, you've got a kid that is 4 years old, and you're going to take this kid and, you know, it is kind of sad. To me, it's frightening that parents seem to have tried to become not just friends with their children, but also enablers. What about telling the kid you're not a girl, you're 4 years old, you don't need a doll, you don't need to dress up, you know, you don't have to ask for a dress and makeup and everything. You're just, you know, just knock it off or you'll get over it or whatever. Having a, you know, having a little bit of wisdom. It just seems like that in a lot of these situations, the parents feel like they have to worship at the feet of the pop culture. All right, so here's a little duet between Elton John and George Michael, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me. This is a very phenomenal performance.
I can't lie no more of your love than I need. All my pictures seem to fade to black and white.
All right. So according to the life of George Michael, when he was growing up and he became famous at a pretty young age, I think, in this group called Wham, he says that he was dating women, that he never really felt like he was, you know, that he could love a woman or he was really in love with a woman. He dated a guy from Brazil. I think it's Anselme Felipe, something like that. And the guy was a fashion designer down there. Anyway, they had this affair, and I think it was this, you know, George Michael's first male relationship, and then the guy dies of AIDS. But here's my question. If you were a counselor and you met somebody, let's just say throw out the window political correctness and all that, rest of that stuff, popular opinion. Somebody came in to your office, and you as a counselor, and they said, I am struggling with my identity. You know, I'm attracted to women, but I'm also attracted to men. And I think that maybe I need to, you know, experiment with men. Would you tell them, yeah, it's a great idea. Go ahead, go for it. Because it seems to me that this guy's, you know, life kind of started spiraling out of control when he got into this lifestyle. And, you know, he's had his boyfriends and whatever. But, you know, he said there was a point when he said he was going down every day to Hampstead Heath. Hampstead Heath is kind of a notorious area. It's a, you know, it's like a park. Heath means, you know, grass. And he went there, he said, every day, and this must have been going on for years. He was smoking 20, 30 marijuana cigarettes a day. He'd get up, light a joint, and then he would drive down at some point during the day to Hampstead Heath to have basically anonymous sex. So, I mean, not saying that all people in the gay lifestyle do that, but there, if you look at the studies, there are a lot of people. There are a lot of gay men that have had a large number of partners. So why is that? I mean, what is it about the gay male world? It's certainly not true in the gay female world, but what is it about that lifestyle that kind of leads to excess in that area? And then there's a lot of drug use and partying in those scenarios. Well, here we go. Here's a little report on George Michael's death, live from CNN. Well, not live, but obviously live when it came out. But this is from December. His body was found around noon in his house. He had a couple houses in Britain, and one of them was kind of in London, and the other one was kind of out in the outskirts of London, and that's where he died.
Michael Holmes, we want to welcome our viewers in the United States as we continue to talk about the death of George Michael. We'll get you back to Finding Jesus in a moment for those domestic viewers. Very sad breaking news. The pop star, pop icon in many ways, mainly from the 80s, but also through the 90s, George Michael, one half originally of the duo Wham, has passed away, just 53 years old. Police in the Thames Valley region, that's just west of London, say they are treating the death, in their words, as unexplained but not suspicious. They released this statement from Michael's publicist that says, quote, "It is with great sadness that we can confirm that our beloved son, brother, and friend, George, passed away peacefully at home over the Christmas period. The family would ask that their privacy be respected at this difficult and emotional time, and there will be no further comment at this stage." The Thames Valley Police did say that they were called to the home at 2 p.m. on Christmas Day, England time. You look back and George Michael sold 100 million records during a career that spanned nearly four decades, an extraordinary evolution during his career from Wham to Faith to Listen Without Prejudice, and his those singles like Faith and Father Figure and Freedom. CNN contributor Michelle Turner takes a look back at his life.
It's the song that had the world tapping their toes. That little ditty, Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. It was 1984, and they were the British boy duo known as Wham. They had several top 10 hits together, but really it was George Michael with that statement t-shirt, alluring eyes, and super moves who quickly took the spotlight, stealing his fame with this chart-topping ballad, Careless Whisper.
All right, so anyway, don't have any patience for that, but there is something that happened to this guy, and maybe the same exact thing happened to Elvis. Maybe it doesn't have anything to do with being gay. On the other hand, you know what happened to Elvis? I just bought two biographies, a two-piece biography, Elvis's beginnings and then Elvis's end, and a highly rated, highly reviewed. I'm looking forward to getting into it. But here's the guy in America who's bigger than George Michael, because there was no pop star that was ever really bigger than Elvis with his, you know, success with recording and also his movie career and just the epic achievements of this guy. And yet we know that he spent years abusing drugs, and he died a very young man, very out of shape, very overweight, died on the toilet studying the Dead Sea Scrolls, as a matter of fact, but had struggled for years with constipation, was on a poor diet, was around people that I think the argument is that they were taking advantage of him. And supposedly Elvis was a real nice guy, a very polite Southern boy, and never lost the yes ma'am and yes sir approach to people. But I mean, he had to be right. I mean, he had to be miserable. So what is it about fame that causes people to abuse drugs? Is it easy access? Is it the schedule they're on if you're an entertainer? Especially if you're a highly successful entertainer, there would be times that you're entertaining, but a lot of times you're not on the stage. And so is it boredom? Just curious. We'll take a little break here and come back and get into the story of heroin. Now, if he was a heroin addict, it would explain a lot of things, George Michael, and it would explain his death, his early death. This could have been an overdose, and there's another story of him being taken to the hospital for unknown reasons, in which that we believe now it was a heroin overdose. But he died alone in bed on Christmas, and by the time his boyfriend got there, he was his body was cold. So what a way to go. Kelly O'Connell, 6:35 a.m. Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523-1450 to call in. I hope you had a great Christmas. And it's the 27th. The year's almost spent. We'll be back to pick it up a little bit more. The heroin rumors of George Michael's untimely demise.
Time stands still before me. Don't you see? On the ladder of my life.
Well, 6:39, here's your headlines. Mall brawls across America, SWAT teams dispatched. At a number of malls, there were brawls involving, I think, mostly kids, but at more than a dozen shopping centers, and fighting over Well, I need to take that back. The first couple that I looked at last night, I think were teens, but it says more than a dozen shopping centers had fights on them. Christmas in Chicago, 43 shot. And worry that gene editing may wipe out geniuses from the DNA pool. And George Michael's secret heroin addiction. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Low oil prices threatening the royal family's control in Saudi Arabia. And Trump saying the United Nations is just a club for people to have a good time. So we had over the last few days an extraordinary act of what some people are calling treason. Not, well, maybe not treason, but backstabbing, certainly, where President Obama allowed the Security Council at the United Nations, which operates off our own soil and with a large cut of our money, Obama allowed his United Nations secretary not to block a criticism against, in a censure, you know, from the United Nations against the Israelis for their building in disputed territories. So they say, number one, Obama is really putting his real feelings about Israel out there, that Obama did not like and does not like Benjamin Netanyahu. And apparently Obama does not like Jews, or he doesn't like the state of Israel in any event. So in any event, here is a little bit on, and this is from actually KVIA, music legend George Michael. Was he a heroin addict? Check it out.
For a good stumble forecast. Howard Iris, thanks so much. Well, we do begin tonight with the latest on George Michael's death. A new report from British newspaper, The Daily Telegraph, is now shining light on what appears to be a very dark last year for the legendary musician. The man closest to him saying Michael was battling a heroin addiction. And this, look at your screen, the last public sighting of the singer and his boyfriend since 2011, Fadi Fawaz. Now, the photo was published today in the Daily Telegraph, but it doesn't say when exactly it was taken. That is him on the right, the singer. He is almost unrecognizable. And what reporters in England are saying tonight, he appears to be very bloated as well, which, according to them, is a sign of a heroin addiction. Now, it's also widely believed that he had been battling this addiction for a little while, and the singer had recently been treated at a hospital for an overdose. Michael's boyfriend told the Daily Telegraph, "We were supposed to be going for Christmas lunch. I went round there to wake him up, and he was just gone, lying peacefully in bed. We don't know what happened yet. Everything had been very complicated recently, but George was looking forward to Christmas, and so was I." And Fadi Fawaz wrapped up his comments saying, "Now everything is ruined. I want people to remember him the way he was. He was a beautiful person." An autopsy will be performed. It's currently about to begin. And then officially the cause of death will be released. Police tonight calling the death unexplained but not suspicious. British media also reporting Michael was filming a documentary about his life. In his last public Facebook post, Michael said that he was busy putting the final touches on that documentary. The 53-year-old was also about to record a new album due out next year. And again, as you're seeing in this video, he first shot to stardom as half of the pop duo in the 80s, known as Wham.
All right, so one of the things that we know is that he had put on a lot of weight, and there's pictures of him in which he looks like he's 250 pounds easy, which made me think of Elvis. But, you know, shouldn't we be telling kids, or is it just obvious that becoming a pop star is not – the way towards happiness? But, you know, so many of these entertainers go through drug dependency. And I just, you know, is it the personalities Or is it the, you know, is it the lifestyle? Is it the atmosphere of these people around? So anyway, George Michael dead. And don't forget that he had this very weird thing happen a couple of years ago where he fell out of a Range Rover going 70 miles an hour down freeway in Britain. And they said he said that he was adjusting himself and had accidentally fallen out. By some miracle, he was not seriously injured. He had a cut on his face and one on his head, but no serious brain injury, no broken bones, really nothing compared to what it should have been. And the lady who skidded to a halt right before she ran him over said that he was just, you know, he had a cut on his face and blood coming down. She didn't recognize him, but there has been a lot of speculation that was a suicide attempt of a extremely unhappy person. 6:46, and we'll be back to finish out the hour. AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450.
Save myself. And saved your way.
Thank you.
One more quote from George Michael, or maybe the first quote I've done. There is no such thing as a reluctant star. Stars are almost always people that want to make up for their own weaknesses by being loved by the public, and I'm no exception to that, 1987. So, anyway, wow, what a way to go, you know. You know, I don't know why we're surprised by the death of famous people. There have been so many of these individuals that have gotten into drugs. And, you know, is it possible that these people get into substance abuse because of the fact that they do have these deep-rooted issues that cause them to look for an inordinate amount of acceptance and love from the public, and then they realize that doesn't really make up for what's going on inside of them. It's not really becoming famous and beloved obviously doesn't necessarily make up for having an unhappy childhood or being rejected by your family, for example. Now, the last view of him, the last time that his neighbors saw him, he was looking out of his country home window as the village Christmas procession passed by, and as the Daily Telegraph says, life going on without him. And they say that he was very self-conscious that his looks had changed so much to a large extent because of his weight gain, but also from his relentless partying. He had gone to a rehab in Switzerland that was 70,000 or about 100,000 or more pounds, $100,000 or more a week, and had been there for 3 months. And the sense now is that he was there, and this is fairly recently. I think that was in 2014. He was struggling with a heroin addiction there. He died alone on Christmas morning, and his boyfriend went and found him. And from the Daily Telegraph, in recent years, the hedonistic lifestyle that the singer became famous for had left the once dashingly handsome pop icon a bloated version of himself. Now, in terms of heroin use and abuse, one person said he's been rushed to A&E hospital on several occasions. He used heroin. It's amazing that he lasted as long as he did. Cardiac arrest. The description of his death is not uncommon for heroin users. And there was some sense that he might have been trying to get back together with his boyfriend, his ex-boyfriend. So anyway, what else you can say, you know, an unhappy guy that and a phenomenally talented one who died much too soon, and which was totally avoidable. Now I've got another story for you, now that we've got about 4 minutes, 3 minutes left here. Kanye West and his wife, speaking of overburdened superstars and people sent into institutions. He is apparently getting divorced by his wife, Kim Kardashian. Because why? Because he told her that he was planning on meeting President Trump. And she said, I guess basically it's either Trump or me. And he went anyway. So now that was the last straw. And Kanye West is getting a divorce. I think that's actually encouraging that the guy's got his own opinion. And I'm trying to see if I can find the actual story here, but that he, oh man, this is so funny. I do feel sorry for these people that go through these tormented, star lifestyles, but the story is that the fact that Kanye West met with Trump, who is apparently he's apparently friends with and has known for quite a while. And Trump said, came out of the meeting and said with him, he said that, you know, he's a good guy. He and I've been friends for a long time. It's kind of interesting that that would lead to a divorce. I mean, you'd think that your husband is friends with the president. He's personal friends with the president who comes out and says, good guy, known him a long time. And your husband just got out out of a mental institute, and the president was still willing to meet him and called him a good guy and a good friend. And he met personally with the president. You would think that would be reason to be excited and proud, but instead, apparently it was the last nail in the coffin. Wow. I mean, you know, Hollywood presents itself as so cutting edge, but it's so disconnected from reality. And just amazing. But anyway, we'll take a break here on the hour. We do have this phenomenal song that reached number one, Don't Let the Sun Go Down on Me, George Michael, Elton John, to take you out. Kelly O'Connell, hope you had a great Christmas, and New Year's is right around the corner. It's ironic that both these days are happening on the weekend, kind of sad, but anyway. Kelly O'Connell, AM Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523, 1450. We're going to talk about Israel and some New Mexico news next. All right, it is the 27th of December, and the days are burning off. The calendar leaves are flying, and we're almost into 2017. And little article, New Mexico, and this is from the Sun News, New Mexico Head Start ranks worst in the nation. In another set of disappointing education statistics, claims the article, New Mexico's Head Start program ranked worst in the nation for instructional quality and workforce preparation, measured through 2014 through to 2015 by Rutgers University. And the claim is that part of it is in poor training. Only 36% of New Mexico's Head Start teachers have a bachelor's degree, compared to 73% nationally. I was under the impression you had to have a bachelor's degree to get a job as a teacher, but apparently not. And NIEER director, which is National Institute of Early Education Research, says the spokesman for that said, if you are not a well-educated, well-prepared teacher, it's almost impossible to do this, to do Head Start. And so it's an $8 billion national program, and they're saying that anyway. So once again, New Mexico comes in last in a bad way, and first in anyway, we've got it backwards as usual. Now, there is a plan, or there's a bill out there that would get rid of the New Mexico Secretary of Education position. And I've got a little report on that from KRQE News. In the meanwhile, breweries are burgeoning in New Mexico, according to the Santa Fe New Mexican. And I will tell you about that in a moment right after this story about New Mexico's killing the Secretary of Education. So here we go. And this is KRQE News 13.
It has been 14 years since the state of New Mexico has had a Board of Education, but one senator is hoping to bring it back. An Albuquerque Democrat is proposing the board and says it would replace the Secretary of Education. News 13's Rebecca Atkins is live in the Newsplex with more. Rebecca?
Well, Dean, in 2002, voters did away with that state board to give the governor full power to decide who would hold the powerful position of Secretary of Education. But this senator wants the position eliminated. Taking politics out of education. That's exactly what Senator Michael Padilla plans to do with his new bill.
Today, we have a situation where we appoint a Secretary of Education every time a governor comes and goes.
Senator Padilla says the governor decides, regardless of what a candidate's qualifications may be.
That, to me, is alarming.
So the Albuquerque senator decided to come up with a bill, eliminating the position entirely. A 10-member school board would take its place.
If you have a question about public education in New Mexico, you can go right to them, and they're your voice on the 10-member state school board.
Padilla says the school board would hire or fire a state school superintendent.
We should have a licensed educator in this role because that way they would better understand what's going on in the classroom every day.
And Padilla isn't the only one hoping for big change in state education. Senator Bill Souls of Las Cruces is proposing a similar bill.
I completely look forward to working with him on this because I think we both have the same goal in mind.
But this isn't the first time Padilla has introduced a bill of this kind. He first started his plan 2 years ago.
The legislation actually never died. We got it almost all the way through the Senate and onto the Senate floor. But we were able to do some more fine-tuning.
He says he's confident this time his bill has a fighting chance.
With the composition of the legislature changing the way that it just did, I think we're in much better shape to actually get this all the way through.
And Senator Padilla has already introduced the bill, so he anticipates it will be hotly debated early in the legislative session. Dean, back to you.
All right, Rebecca, thank you. Senator Padilla says if both the House and the Senate support his bill, it will go straight to the voters in 2018.
All right. Another story here on New Mexico breweries, Santa Fe, New Mexican. And according to an article that was published by state economist Adam Garcia in the November New Mexico Labor Market Review, we are now number 12th in the nation per capita for small brewers with 2.3 per 100,000 people. Vermont had the highest at 7.3 per 100,000, while Mississippi was at 0.3. And the top five, Montana, Colorado, Oregon, Maine, are up there. And Garcia listed 47 small breweries in the state, with 25 in Albuquerque and 5 in Santa Fe. And he points out that the businesses are also spread throughout the state. So we have breweries in Farmington, Eagle Nest, Las Cruces, Portales, Artesia, Moriarty, Los Alamos, Embudo, wherever that is, El Prado, Taos, Silver City, and Fair Acres. And in terms of the economic impact, $340 million a year, 45 businesses have increased their employment from 1,000 in 2012 to 1,500 in 2015, wages coming out at $8.5 million. Mabel Brewery has the most employees with 54. Santa Fe Brewing Company at 50. And in terms of production, 27th in production per capita. So that's cool, isn't it? I mean, these places are kind of cool, these artisan breweries. New Mexico Nuclear Waste Plant, the waste isolation pilot plant has been cleared for reopening. And one more story about wind energy. Green energy, especially wind energy, is up and coming and is right now $350,000 homes are supplied by wind energy, and if the number of wind units comes on as is proposed, it'll double that to 700,000. So, you know, that's maybe at least a third of the state's energy coming from wind. So one of the issues is there are tax credits now until 2020. Federal production for tax credit pays 2.3 cents for every kilowatt hour of electricity from wind farms, and this has created a growth in this area. Now, where are these wind farms located? Massive wind farms are either planned or under construction in Torrance and Curry counties, including two interrelated projects. And this is from the Albuquerque Journal, by the way. Two interrelated projects near Clovis totaling 497 megawatts of generating capacity, and then a 298 megawatt project near Moriarty El Cabo wind farm will open next year, and three other projects ranging from 30 megawatts to 250 megawatts in the planning stages. Now, there's 13 wind facilities now with 1.1 gigawatt capability, and they plan to increase that to 20 wind farms with 2.2, so the doubling of the energy. And El Cabo is a $500 million project from Oregon-based Avangrid Renewables. And tax credits, technological advances, and other elements have pushed price down by 66% over the last 5 years. And manufacturers are making taller turbines and bigger blades with larger rotary diameters, creating a lot more energy. Now, when they say here, SPS generation in New Mexico and Texas, 20% of our energy coming from wind right now. So anyway, kind of interesting in there. If you go to the Albuquerque Journal, there's a map, a state map of the wind farms, and most of them are in the east. Broadview, Caprock, Brahms, New Mexico, Grady, Llano Estacio, San Juan Mesa, Roosevelt, Anderson. These are all names of these, and they're in the middle of the state on the border for the most part. So, all right, let us take a little break. We'll come back and we're going to discuss what the president did, which is being described as a knife in the back to Israel. Obviously, the president doesn't really like Israel. Whatever his beef is, it's got to be political, because the president is nothing but politics, you know. And I'm going to switch up gears here. I'm going to play a song that was inspired by the rise of fascist anti-Semitism. It's by a Canadian band called Red Rider. Lunatic Fringe is an amazing song. So I'm dedicating this to President Obama and his anti-Semitism. And it's amazing that the real Obama is coming out now. It's very scary and unnerving. And if you're living in Israel right now, you got to be on pins and needles. But Trump says that he's going to come back and he's going to do what he can to wipe this decision out. But very shameful, folks, and very, very scary that how politically minded this president is, and he doesn't mind changing his position to let his true nature out when he has nothing else to lose. I know we're out there. All right, so President Obama is now put out the information that if he had run against Trump, he would have beat him. So, now, President Obama is a weird person, I will say this. But, you know, one of the strangest things about the guy is his interest in the Democratic Party didn't appear to be any bigger than the Oval Office. Just my impression. Here is a reaction to the fact that President Obama, and this is from Alan Dershowitz, the youngest person to ever become a professor at Harvard University, and he was involved. Wasn't he involved in the O.J. Simpson case? In any event, claiming he will go down in history as one of the worst foreign policy presidents ever. Well, that covers half the ground there. And find something good that he's done on the other side in domestic policy making. Anyway, here's Dershowitz.
He will go down in history, President Obama, as one of the worst foreign policy presidents ever. He called me into the Oval Office before the election, and he said to me, Alan, I want your support, and I have to tell you, I will always have Israel's back. I didn't realize what he meant is that he would have his back to stab them in the back. Mm. And what he did was so nasty. He pulled a bait and switch. He said to the American public, oh, this is all about the settlements deep in the West Bank. And yet he allowed his representatives to the UN to abstain, which is really for a resolution that says the Jews can't pray at the Western Wall. Right. Jews can't live in the Jewish quarter where they've lived for thousands of years. And he's going to say, whoops, I didn't mean that. Well, read the resolution. You're a lawyer. You went to Harvard Law School.
Not a big fan of Obama anymore. But what did all these people see in Obama anyway? Well, I guess Obama just told people what they wanted to hear. Here is Benjamin Netanyahu, whose country has been directly influenced by this catastrophe at the United Nations.
Over decades, American administrations and Israeli governments have disagreed about settlements, but we agreed that the Security Council was not the place to resolve this issue. We knew that going there would make negotiations harder and drive peace further away. And as I told John Kerry on Thursday, friends don't take friends to the Security Council. I'm encouraged by the statements of our friends in the United States, Republicans and Democrats alike. They understand how reckless and destructive this UN resolution was. They understand that the Western Wall isn't occupied territory. I look forward to working with those friends and with the new administration when it takes office next month.
All right, there is from Bibi Netanyahu. And here is an extraordinary statement from the Israeli government spokesman who said that Obama actually had a hand in writing the resolution condemning Israel, which would be new, even for Obama, would be an epic achievement.
He is a spokesman for the Israeli prime minister. David, thank you so much for joining me. Obviously, the prime minister and many people in your country are very upset. Tell us first and foremost about what he plans to say to the U.S. ambassador in their meeting this evening there.
Well, I'll leave that to the prime minister and the American ambassador. But what I can say is that Israelis collectively and the government in particular deeply, deeply disappointed at this Security Council vote. You know, according to this Security Council resolution, the Western Wall, one of the holiest places to the Jewish people, a place where Jews have lived and prayed to and turned to for literally thousands of years, is deemed illegally occupied. That's ahistorical, that's immoral, and it's just plain wrong. And therefore, the government, I think very rightly, saw this resolution as actually a step not towards peace, but away from peace. It actually makes peace harder to attain. What this resolution says is that the presence of Jews living in Judea is really the barrier to peace. It's not the fact that the Palestinians refuse to recognize a Jewish state in any boundaries whatsoever. It's not the fact that the Palestinian leadership and authority is constantly indoctrinating young children with the idea that it's better to kill an Israeli than to live in peace with it. The real barrier to peace are policies like the Palestinian leadership has enacted to actually pay salaries to people who murder Israelis.
So given all of that,
shameful, and it actually pushes peace farther away.
Given all of that, why does your boss, the prime minister, think that the Obama administration did what it did?
Well, we have ironclad information, frankly, that the Obama administration really helped push this resolution and helped craft it from sources internationally and from sources in the Arab world. And it's really an unfortunate legacy, a kind of last-minute jab at Israel that actually distances peace. And I applaud leaders of both the Democratic and Republican parties who have come out and blasted this deeply anti-Israel resolution, this resolution that unfairly targets Israel from a body which to say is biased would truly be to understand.
David, let me just stop you right there. You are saying you have ironclad information effectively that's engaged in collusion with the Palestinians to get this resolution passed. Can you give that to the public? Can you make it public to prove what you're saying is true?
Unfortunately, I can't, not here on CNN, but I can tell you that we have full confidence the information is accurate.
All right. So what would it mean if the president colluded with the Palestinians to write a denunciation of Israel and ran it through the United Nations? And so, I mean, I think what it means is that the president is more committed to the Palestinians than he is Israel. He had to go along with Israel to get elected and to get the support of many prominent Christians and Jews, that he doesn't really care for Israel. And as a matter of fact, in my opinion, has outed himself as an anti-Semitic person, just my particular reading of it. But the Jews are being driven out of Europe by all of the radical Islam going on there, and the fact that the governments are not really protecting them like they could. And large parts of places like Brussels, places like Paris, taken over. And there are streets that are shut down daily for Muslim prayer. So it's still a very dangerous world for the Jews. Here is a song, though, dedicated to shining a light on anti-Semitism, Lunatic Fringe. Kelly O'Connell, 7:30 a.m., Las Cruces, AM 1450, 523-1450. You're listening to KOBE. We'll be right back. I've got a spin on this. There's an interesting reason, or there's an interesting element. I have a couple of friends of mine asked me to put a little more religious content in to the show, and I've been trying to think of how to do that. And there is an element of the Jewish connection to America that's very interesting. Some people believe that the Jews of the Old Testament have a lot of prophecies, and that's why they're still around. And that's why they're going to be important in the eschaton in the last days. Other people believe that the church has taken the place of Israel, which is kind of an interesting idea. It's called replacement theology. I'll come back and play a little clip on that for you. Kelly O'Connell, 7:31.
I can hear you.
You know, it is weird how pro-Islam Obama has been. You know, there are many people being killed for being Christians in the Middle East and tortured, and the president is breaking his back to get even more and more and more Muslims from the Middle East over here, and yet almost none of them are Christians, and yet this guy claims to be a Christian, so... You know, there's something very odd about Obama and all of these problems. All of the supposed contradictions can be explained quite easily by pointing out that Obama is a card-carrying Marxist or socialist. You know, Marxist, the USSR, had a tremendous problem with Jews, and it killed a number of them, and it sent them into concentration camps, and it also exported many of them, famously during the 1970s, into sent them over to Israel. It didn't want Jews. Karl Marx wrote an essay called about the Jewish problem, and communism and socialism, despite the fact that many prominent socialists have been Jewish, including Karl Marx had Jewish blood, a large number of socialists and far leftists are Jewish, and they say that's because they've lost their religion. Well, speaking of losing your religion and not talking about REM, replacement theology. Now, one of the reasons that Americans feel a connection to Israel is we retain our basic identity as a Christian nation, even if we're not acting on it, even if we're not educated on it, on what it means. But there is this deeply felt sense that the Jewish people, according to the Bible, were God's chosen and continue to be God's chosen. And these are covenants that are irrevocable or irreplaceable, or you couldn't cancel them. Can't be canceled. And so if God talks to the Jews in the Old Testament and gives them promises in the future, and if there's promises to the Jews in the New Testament that this is all a continuation of this status. Now, there is another counter movement called replacement theology that says since the Jews walked away from God, they rejected Jesus, that the church has taken the place of Israel. Here's this idea.
The following is a presentation of God Questions Ministries.
What is replacement theology? Replacement theology essentially teaches that the church has replaced Israel in God's plan. Adherents of replacement theology believe the Jews are no longer God's chosen people, and God does not have specific future plans for the nation of Israel. All the different views of the relationship between the church and Israel can be divided into two camps. Either the church is the continuation of Israel, replacement or covenant theology, or the church is completely different and distinct from Israel, dispensationalism and premillennialism. Replacement theology teaches that the church is the replacement for Israel, and that the many promises made to Israel in the Bible are fulfilled in the Christian church, not in Israel. So the prophecies in Scripture concerning the blessing and restoration of Israel to the promised land are spiritualized or allegorized into promises of God's blessing for the church. Major problems exist with this view, such as the continuing existence of the Jewish people throughout the centuries, and especially with the revival of the modern state of Israel. If Israel had been condemned by God, and there is no future for the Jewish nation, how do we explain the supernatural survival of the Jewish people over the last 2,000 years, despite the many attempts to destroy them? How do we explain why and how Israel reappeared as a nation in the 20th century after not existing for 1,900 years? The view that Israel and the church are different is clearly taught in the New Testament. Biblically speaking, the church is completely different and distinct from Israel, and the two are never to be confused or used interchangeably. We are taught from Scripture that the church is an entirely new creation that came into being on the day of Pentecost and will continue until it is taken to heaven at the rapture, Ephesians 1 verses 9 through 11. The church has no relationship to the curses and blessings for Israel. The covenants, promises, and warnings are valid only for Israel. Israel has been temporarily set aside in God's program during these past 2,000 years of dispersion. After the rapture, 1 Thessalonians 4 verses 13 through 18, God will restore Israel as the primary focus of his plan. The first event at this time is the tribulation, Revelation chapters 6 through 19. The world will be judged for rejecting Christ, while Israel is prepared through the trials of the great tribulation for the second coming of the Messiah. Then, when Christ does return to the earth, at the end of the tribulation, Israel will be ready to receive him. The remnant of Israel which survives the tribulation will be saved, and the Lord will establish his kingdom on this earth with Jerusalem as its capital. With Christ reigning as king, Israel will be the leading nation and representatives from all nations will come to Jerusalem to honor and worship the King, Jesus Christ. The church will return with Christ and will reign with him for a literal 1,000 years, Revelation 20, verses 1 through 5. Both the Old Testament and the New Testament support a premillennial and dispensational understanding of God's plan for Israel. Even so, the strongest support for premillennialism is found in the clear teaching of Revelation 20.
All right, so basically the story is that in the minds of some people, and I have no idea what percentage of individuals actually espouse this idea, but the notion that the church has taken the place of Israel and has taken all of the promises and blessings and everything. Now, that is one reason that, and there's a large number of, there is a fairly large number of Americans that believe this, that that would be one reason that they wouldn't support Israel. Now, the general opinion of American Christianity, I think, and I believe this has been shown to be true, the amount of support that we've given Israel since it was created in 1948, is that as long as we support Israel, we will be blessed. So this is an area where you see very firm religious convictions overlapping with policy. Now, on the alternative, why would Obama get up and have anything to do with a bill or a motion in the United Nations that actually would, if it was passed, demand that the Jews move out of the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem and stop going to the Wailing Wall? I mean, that is an extraordinary attack on the Jews, because basically what you're doing is claiming that Jerusalem is a Muslim city, that the Temple Mount belongs to the Dome of the Rock, and that the temple can never be rebuilt. So therefore, the aspirations of the Jews, which we've already covered on the show, to rebuild the temple are false and should never be addressed. So, I mean, I don't know what else that Obama has to do to show that he supports Islam, but it has been a very perilous and dangerous and damaging tour with Obama for two terms, and we haven't seen the worst of it probably yet. 744, here is a song dedicated to shining a light on anti-Semitism. Therefore, it is dedicated to Barack Obama and his anti-Semitic attack on Israel through the United Nations, Lunatic Fringe. Well, they say that Trump will invalidate 60 to 70% of Obama's decision making, his executive orders, with in one day, which would be interesting. And no wonder Obama seems to feel so frustrated towards him. Now, time for one of our sponsors. Cafe Go-Go. And they're having a big New Year's Eve party, so make sure you get over there. Across from Sam's Club. Great lunch is the best burgers in town from Baca Ranch. And just beautiful burgers. And a lot of great food. I think they're bringing a ribeye back on the menu, so get over there. All right, so what do you think, kind of switching gears back to what we were talking about earlier, parenting a transgender child from the Daily Telegraph the day my four-year-old son told me he was a girl. So the Powell family decided that the four-year-old boy could transition into a girl. And so what did mama do, the good mama? She said, part of me went through a kind of mourning for the child I thought I had, Catherine Powell, who apparently wears the pants in the family. She began researching online and found videos of transgender children in America, like Jazz Jennings, the teenage YouTube personality who transitioned to female aged 5, Susie Green, at a charity called Mermaids UK, helps children to transition. I mean, they've done studies and found that most kids who say that they're born in the wrong body, or most kids that have a fixation with becoming or being the other gender, that it's just a phase and it goes away. But, you know, so you're going to go online onto YouTube to do research to decide if your children's going to get a sex change? That is incredible. So anyway, they put this kid, I got to find this cover of this thing, but I believe it was National Geographic, something like that. So they totally politicize National Geographic, if that's it. Let me see, though, if I can find this. I'm sure I can. This story is just incredible. Well, I'll find it on the break for you. But anyway, what do you think about that? I mean, it just seems to me, you know, these kids that get involved with this and adults who get sex changes, there's 40% of these people that attempt suicide, and another 10% refuse to live as their new gender, another 10%. Say that it was a mistake. So it's a failed undertaking. It's a failed procedure. It's people with mental health issues or psychological fixations. And, you know, so they go ahead and give these people sex changes, and it doesn't cure their problems. And the guy that was the head of the, and I'm sure that I've talked about this before, Dr. Paul McHugh, who was the head of the sex change surgery unit at John Hopkins, which has been shut down because it was found to be ineffective, said that you cannot give this procedure to people and then consider that they've changed their gender. There's no way to change people's genders. So anyway, take one last break. We'll be back to finish her up. Kelly O'Connell, 523-1450 on AM Las Cruces. All right, so here's this. anyway, here's this. There's a little clip from this kid that's transitioning. Well, actually, this is a different one. So there's a couple of kids out there. Well, anyway, now I don't have to pretend to be a boy, transgendered girl, 9 stars on the cover of New National Geographic. So do you think it's appropriate for National Geographic to have something like that on the front cover? I mean, it seems like all these institutions are being conscripted, openly conscripted into this, it's not just whether what gender somebody is, it's the idea that people are not born with a particular identity in it, which I find strange. Now, you're supposed to accept these people based on their subjective experience as being of a different gender, of being trans. But when this lady, even though there's no indicia to prove that these people are born in the wrong body or a different gender, because we've exploded the whole definition of gender anyway. But then when you've got this lady who pretends to be black and becomes the head of the NCAA in Washington and claims that she has a black identity and identifies with the movement, and they find out that she doesn't have any black blood, and they just attack her viciously and throw her out of the NAACP, pardon me. I guess NCAA is sports. But they throw her out, and, it's white. If you can be any gender you want, why can't you be any race? Now, in the meantime, Pennsylvania professor under fire for white genocide, Drexel University professor from Philadelphia, tweeted that he wanted a white genocide for Christmas. George Ariello Mayer, white assistant professor of history and politics at Philadelphia, says, "All I want for Christmas is white genocide." And to clarify, he says, when the whites were massacred during the Haitian Revolution, that was a good thing indeed. And so they've gone after him, and he said it was just a joke. But there's so much confusion out there, and our entire society is being driven by these crazy ideas that are coming out of the elites. And in the midst of trying to survive a war from radical Islam, we've got this crap going on. 7:59, thanks for tuning in. Have a great day. Kelly O'Connell, I'm Las Cruces. Ciao. Lunatic Fringe.